age.
Yeah, it's true. All right, let me try this one. Okay, Micro Secretary. Applause, applause.
The next line after Joanne.
Yeah.
Yeah, same story. I'm coming in the next line is here.
Yeah, no chips at all.
Just later.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Down here. Down here after she. Then we'll get back to me.
All right. Without any further ado, let me introduce our main speaker tonight.
Oh, no.
DJ Shea from California.
Hello, my name is Shay and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, wow.
Let me first start off by saying I really didn't want to speak tonight. And I tried to weasel my way out of it. I pulled the work card because everybody knows that I have a pretty stressful job in management, and I have to work a lot of hours, and it's just it's crazy. I don't know like when I'm going to be working. I'm supposed to only work 40 hours a week. It usually ends up being like 50, 55 hours a week. Yeah, all the quality problems that I have of living a life that I live today, right? And I got to thinking about it, and I was like, you know what, Shay, you've been really selfish lately. You really should share your story. And I went up to Billy and I said, you know what, Billy, I'll go ahead and make it work. And so I'm here. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I wish I could say that I came from a good family, like Joanne. My mother divorced my dad when I was 2 and left, and my dad married my stepmom when I was about 2.5, 3 years old, and she was definitely a full-blown alcoholic. She was a functioning alcoholic. She was also very abusive in every way imaginable, and I got the brunt of the abuse because I was the stepchild, and I had to put up with that for quite some time. And in fact, one of the some of the abuse that I was enduring continued until I was 12 and stopped because my sister caught wind of it and took a baseball bat to her and said that if she did it again, she was going to kill her. And I didn't really have the best of family life. My dad was a good man, but he worked a lot. He was always at work. He worked at an auto parts store, and he went to school part time. And he was just doing what he could to provide a good life for us, you know. And I know that he cared about me very much and loved me very much. I think I like to say that a lot of the reasons why I drank and got loaded was when I discovered alcohol and the other substances, you know, drugs are definitely a part of my story too. They numbed me from the shame and the guilt and all that stuff that I was dealing as a kid, you know. I will say that I'm grateful to drugs and alcohol for doing that at a time that it did, because I don't think I think I probably would have committed suicide had they not been there when I needed them. So, but anyway, to make a long story short. I had that stigma of knowing that things were different and that I wasn't, had no real significant people that were around in my life. You know, that my dad, of course, but he was, he was always working. He wasn't really there. And my stepmom, I didn't like her at all. So I didn't really have a lot of people that were there for me. I didn't really have any good influences around. My dad bought an auto dismantling yard, and I don't know if you guys know anything about auto dismantling yards, but there's lots of booze, and they hire a lot of felons. but there's a lot of a lot of stuff that goes on in those shops, and here I was, 13, 14, and I was already doing bad in school because of me being so screwed up with everything that was going on at home. That my stepmom basically told my dad, if you don't get him out of the house, I'll kill him. So I would go and I would work with him at his shop, and I loved it there because I got to be one of the cool guys. I got to walk around with a cigarette in my mouth, and I didn't even smoke. You know, I loved it because, you know, I'd go and I'd get all dirty and pretend that I was doing something, but that would give me like $50 a week, something ridiculous. But, you know, I just liked being out of the house, you know, and I liked, you know, the guys were cool, you know, I thought that was what cool people did. They had a bunch of tattoos, you know, and they got to drive the forklift, and that was what inspired me. I was like, wow, you know, I'm going to be a forklift driver, I'm going to do all this cool stuff. And so, you know, I believe I was 13 years old, and the first thing that I did, the first head change that I got was not alcohol. It was a pot. I smoked out of a bong. One of the coworkers made a bong out of some toilet paper rolls and something. And I sat there and I smoked it, and I got this head change, and I was like, wow, this is really good. And he goes, you're probably not going to feel anything the first time you smoke it. I felt something. I was messed up beyond. I mean, it was like the greatest thing. You know, I finally felt that I fit in. You know, I was like, wow, you know, where has this been all my life? And I felt pretty damn good, you know. The first time I drank was probably a couple of weeks after, after we would pretty much lock up the yard, the yard closed at 5, the guys would pretty much take it in the break room and have a couple of beers. Well, I told them, hey, you know, wait, I want one of those beers. Oh, if your dad finds out, he'll kill us. I don't care, just give me a beer. So they gave me a beer, and my dad called one of them into the office and said that they had to work and do some overtime, that they needed a motor out of a car that needed to be delivered the next day. So here I am. I had that beer, and I snuck into the refrigerator while they were doing what they were doing, and I had a couple more. So needless to say, here I was, a 13-year-old kid, had never drank before in his life. I had 3 beers. I was pretty much 3 shifts to the wind. And they didn't know what else to do with me. They put me on the back of the forklift, and they said, you just sit there and don't do a damn thing. If you move, if you say anything, we'll kill you. And I was like, okay, all right. And of course, you know, I was drunk, so I was swaying back and forth. And my dad came out, and he was like, hey, how's it going? Are you learning something? You know, are you learning how to pull a motor? And I was like, oh, yeah, Dad, I'm learning, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. You know what, son? You don't look too good. Maybe I should take you home. It's been a long day for you. Let's go home and get you showered. And so he did, and I remember waking up the next day, and I had the worst headache, and I just, you know, was not having it. And I was like, oh, my God, what the hell's going on? But I know that when I drank that beer and I felt cool, I felt like I was a part of. And I had not, never felt like I was a part of in my life, ever, whatsoever. So needless to say, I started experimenting a little bit with alcohol. I couldn't really get over the hangover part. I didn't really like that all that much. So, you know, it was more, I was more of an herbal kind of guy. So I was doing that, and then, let's see, I turned 15. I was going to a private school, and I had a vendetta against one of the football players. He was a big old jerk, and he used to tease me relentlessly, and his girlfriend and me got along really well, and I ended up sleeping with her and getting her pregnant. And and needless to say, this was a private school. The girl that I got pregnant was also the pastor's daughter of the school. So I got asked to leave, and they basically kicked me out of school, kicked her out of school. My son was born a week before my 16th birthday. So I had to learn how to grow up quick, or I don't know what I would call what I was doing back in that day. I was no kind of father figure whatsoever. I mean, I just I had just discovered drinking and doing all that other stuff that I was doing. The last thing I wanted to do was be a father. And you know, I told my dad, I said, well, you know, she wants to give the baby up for adoption. Well, she's not doing that. You are going to raise that baby. You know, that is your son. You know, that is your child. You're going to raise that baby. She's going to move in with you. You know, you were going to take care of her. And okay, here I was, you know, barely 16, and I had a girlfriend and a son living with me. And it was really bad. It was really bad because my stepmom did not like her at all and would call her all kinds of names, and it just it got really bad really quick. It got to the point to where some things had happened, and my mom was at a party, and she made some comments to one of her boozing friends about some things that had transpired between me and her. And 2 days later, CPS was at the house. They were taking me and my sister to Child Protective Services. And and it was not looking good for her. And I don't know, I think she got an attorney, my dad intervened or something, but she was released from jail, and they came to the emergency shelter, and they got my sisters. And I was like, well, what about me? What's going to happen to me? Oh, well, you're going to have to stay here until we can find a place to place you. And so, you know, the thought of going into a foster care, it didn't really bother me all that much. It really didn't. Anyway, what happened was I had a cousin that stepped up and was willing to let me stay with him. And my girlfriend ended up moving back in with her parents. Within 3 months, she couldn't really deal with Tyler, my son. So she sent him to stay with me. So, you know, here I was 17, and I was basically raising my son by myself. My cousin was helping, but I was working three jobs. I was working at McDonald's, I was working at a coffee shop as a barista, and then I think I was I busing back then too? Yeah, I was working three jobs, and I was doing what I could to survive. And the only real help that I had was from my cousin and one of the girls that lived in the apartment complex, because she was in love with me. I guess I was cute back then, so she would help, and she would babysit, and she didn't really have much of a life going on, you know, it was really, really hard, and I remembered wanting to drink, and I remembered wanting to get high, and I was like, fuck, I can't, you know, and, you know, I was just all kinds of sad, because all I wanted to do was feel that ease and comfort, because I was so stressed out, and I didn't know, you know, it got really bad really quick. My son was becoming more of an inconvenience to me, you know, and that's a really crappy thing to say, and I'm very ashamed that that was the case for so long, but, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one that feels that way, you know, or was acting that way when they were out in their disease, so. My drinking and my drug use progressed really quickly. Because of the relationship with my dad and my stepmom, I didn't really have them in my life. I had a couple of, you know, my sisters. One was a year younger than me, and the other one was 10 years younger than me. And we were somewhat close, but because of all this, it kind of put a strain on our relationship, too. So I just felt myself drifting further and further away from the family. I think it was a good thing, because with everything that was going on, it could have been a lot worse for me. So needless to say, I was doing my thing, and I was living in Long Beach, and I met the girl of my dreams like 2 months before my 21st birthday, and I was in love with this chick. And let me tell you that it's not a good idea to fall in love with a girl that works as a stripper. One of my friends, I was having a really bad day, and he said, hey, I'm going to take you out. I'm going to get you drunk. I'm going to take you to this, I don't know what the bar was called. We're going to go to the strip club. And we did, and she gave me a lap dance, and she chased after me afterwards and was like, hey, what's your number? You're cute. So I gave her my number. We hooked up. We started dating. And then shortly after I turned 21, she comes over and says, hey, babe, I have a really good job opportunity in Las Vegas with Philip Morris. And I was like, well, maybe you should take it. Well, I know, but I kind of don't want to leave you, and blah, blah, blah. And, of course, you know, I had my son, and I was like, well, you know, I don't know what to tell you. I don't really think going out to Las Vegas would be a good place for me to raise a kid. And as if it was fate or something, but my baby's mama called and said, hey, we need to talk about Tyler. You know, I want him to come with me to Massachusetts and live with me and my family over the summer. And I was like, oh, really? Okay, all right, that's fine. Yeah, go ahead and come and get him. So she did. And I called her up and I said, hey, babe, you know, I think I'll move to Texas or I'll move to Vegas with you. And so I did. You know, I was 21. I moved to Vegas. What I really liked about Vegas back then was that you take in a couple of rolls of nickels and sit there at the nickel shop, and they'll bring you whatever you want to drink. So that's, you know, that was my best escape. You know, I just sit at the slot machines, and I didn't have my son. She was off doing her thing. It was great, you know. I always had these periods where I struggled or where it seemed like I was struggling, but I always seemed to bounce back really quick. I was always, I guess I would let my disease take me down as far as I could, and then I would try and build myself back up just to prove that I could, if that makes any sense. Because that's how I told myself, well, I don't really have a problem. It can't be the alcohol or the drugs. And I did that a couple of times, you know. I had a really good job. I was in a show in Las Vegas, and I was doing really good. And my ex, she wasn't doing so good, and she started stripping on the side again, which I really didn't care. You know, I mean, she was really hot, so, you know, it didn't really bother me. At least I was going home with her, or at least that's what I was telling myself. And So, I mean, you know, it's just like the warped mind of an alcoholic, you know. And then I was with one of my friends, and we were going through one of the rags that they give you on the strip, you know, with the girls and all that stuff. And we were looking at these girls that were advertising for alcohols. And I saw this this girl, you know, from the waist down, and it looked like someone that I knew. And I was like, no, that can't be her. That can't be her. And sure enough, he calls and sets up an appointment with her. She comes to the bar, it's her. So that relationship ended pretty drastically. And I ended up moving, and then I moved to Colorado for a while, and it was just that was where I got my first DUI, you know. And when they were arresting me, I was like, you can't do this, blah, 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 yada, 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 you know. I blew a .02, but I smoked so much pot, like I couldn't even stand up. And I was like, you know, I'm not drunk, you know, this isn't a DUI. I'm not drunk, you can't do this. And so they did. And, you know, they set me up with probation and all that stuff. And instead of fulfilling the needs of all that stuff, the requirements of all that, I just got up and left. I got up and left, and I moved to Austin, Texas. And in Austin, Texas, that's when things got really, really bad, really, really quick. I had started DJing when I was like 17, 18, just as something fun to do to pass the time. And I had done little like stints here and there, you know, like friends would hook me up with the odd jobs and stuff like that. I always had my own equipment from as far back as I could remember. It was the only thing that I really held on to during my disease, you know. So I was in Austin, Texas, and I was DJing at this prestigious club called the Boy Cellar. And it was quite an interesting place. They had a nice little dungeon room, which is where I spent a lot of my time because it was nice and dark. And as long as the drugs and the alcohol kept coming, I didn't really care what happened. So I was down there one night, and some interesting person came up to me and said that they wanted to give me $300 for the boxers I was wearing. So I took them off, and I gave them to him, and he gave me the $300. I went to Kmart, and I bought another 12-pack. You know, it's just really, really sick stuff that you know, I just, so needless to say, there were some drag queens there that got this bright idea that we could have these guys take me home, and then they would give me some Rohypnol to put in their drinks, and then once they passed out, I would take their wallet and leave, yada, 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 blah, 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 you know. And so, you know, I did that a few times. One of them wanted a twofer, so my drag queen friend went with me. We didn't give the guy enough roofies, and he woke up and caught her and was going to town on her, like beating the crap out of her. And, you know, a normal person would have called the cops and would have tried to help his friend. I bailed. So, but it was really, really bad. I was drinking. I was doing all kinds of drugs under the sun, ecstasy, anything that could just change me. You know, I was not happy with who I was. I think this is the point where I realized that something had to change because I didn't, you know, my life was just, it was spiraling out of control really quick. I had failed relationships. I just couldn't have relationships with anybody whatsoever. I tried, like, I mean, I was fine with sex, but as far as anything else, you know, I just couldn't do it. I really couldn't. I was a liar, cheater, and a thief, you know, by all definitions. You know, I just, I let alcohol pretty much control me. And it got to the point to where I was in Austin, and I was so miserable, and I remember telling myself, hey, you know, something's got to give. I can't keep doing this anymore. And what a coincidence. I get a blast from the past. My ex-girlfriend from Las Vegas had hunted me down and found me in Texas and found me and was like, hey, you know, I want to get back together with you. I miss you. I love you. You know, the way I treated you was crappy, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. She was definitely one of us. She was more into the chemical aspects of what she was doing, but she, you know, she was one of us. So she was living with her mother in Arizona. I ended up back in Arizona with her and her mother, which, you know, for someone to be living with their parents, it's probably not a good idea for you to move in with them. And I got back there, not even a week later, it was the same thing. She was disappearing. By this time, she had graduated to shooting up meth. And, you know, she was one of the most beautiful women I've ever met in my whole entire life. And by the time we broke up, she just, yeah, it was horrible, absolutely horrible. And she ended up committing suicide not too long after we broke up. And that's what threw me for a loop, and I think definitely helped my disease progress a lot. I was by this time I had gotten into contact with my mother, and she was living out in Napomo, And she had noticed that, you know, with all this stuff going on that I was stressing out, she's like, hey, you know, I want to help you. Why don't you come out here and get to know me? You know, I left when you were two. I'll help you. You can stay out here. We have a car you can drive. You won't have to pay any rent. You know, just come out here and get away. And so I did. And, you know, I came out to Napomo, and I thought, okay, California's going to be a fresh start. You know, I'm going to come out here. I'm going to have the best attitude. I'll get a job. I'll bounce back up. It'll be okay. The only problem with that is that I took me with me. You know, so I came out to Napomo, and it was just the same old thing. You know, my mom liked to smoke pot. So, you know, we were always smoking pot, and I was drinking, and, you know, it was just the same thing. And it kept on for the longest time. I ended up moving out after 3 months of staying with her because I just couldn't, it was just too weird, I guess. And she was on me about my drinking, saying that I was drinking too much. Well, screw you. You know, if you think I'm drinking too much, then I got to go, you know. And so I moved out, and I moved into, I moved in with some friends in Santa Maria. And I was working at the Olive Garden. I was doing okay by my definition. You know, I was holding down a job. I had a place to stay. I just bought a car. So things were going good in Shay's world. And I just partied up, and I ended up leaving the Olive Garden because they weren't kissing my ass. They weren't giving me the hours that I wanted and the pay that I wanted, so I was like, well, screw you guys. I ended up getting a job somewhere else. I ended up at a party. I took a bunch of pills. I wasn't trying to kill myself. I was just trying to get high, and I took like maybe 60 different types of pills that were at this party, and I was at Marianne. I woke up. They said, you were very lucky, we're going to send you to Santa Barbara because you tried to kill yourself. And I was like, wait a minute, I didn't try to kill myself, I was trying to get high, I was partying. So needless to say, they didn't send me, which they probably should have. And that started the worst week of my life. That was the week before I found Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just remembered that I got out of the hospital, they said, you can't drink, you can't do anything, you have to go straight home, and you have to get some rest. I got out of, you know, they wheel you out in the wheelchair. I got in the car. I told my friend, okay, we need to stop by the liquor store. I need a bottle. And I drank that bottle, and nothing happened. Like, I was stone cold freaking sober. And then it hit me. Oh, my God. You know, what the hell am I doing? And I just remember all these thoughts, like, rushing into my mind. You know, like, just everything at once. You know, it was just pouring. I could not get my mind to shut up. And it just got to the point where everything was so loud and getting to me so much that I wanted to kill myself. And I had one of the few decent friends that I had back in the day. His name was Travis. I called him up and I said, Travis, I don't know what to do. I want to kill myself. And he goes, no, don't do that. I'll take you to see my pastor in the morning. Just hang tight. You know, I'll even come over and hang out with you if you want. So the next day we went and met with his pastor. And she agreed to help me. She goes, well, you know, I'll definitely, you can come here to the church. You can fellowship with us. I'll even meet with you and do some counseling on the side if you want. But I really think you should try and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, okay, all right, fine. You know, if you think that I need to go, I'll go and I'll check it out. And so that was September 30th of 2008, my first meeting that I went to. It was at the what used to be the Alana Club way back when. And I remember I was so nervous at that meeting. I got there like 30 minutes early, and I saw a bunch of people like Al McGeehee. I think Billy might have even been there. It was a new meeting. Just a bunch of like older people, and I thought, oh my God, you know, there's all these old people. I'm not going to fit in, you know. And basically what had happened was not even like 15 minutes after I sat down, I was like, oh, well, you know, I promised this lady I would go. I might as well just stay. A bunch of people from detox came. And there were some younger people. That's how I met Dave. And I was like, okay, well, you know, maybe this place isn't going to be that bad. And I don't know what I heard or what happened in that first meeting, but all of a sudden, I kind of had a feeling that things were going to be okay. At least I knew that they were going to be different. So I met a man by the name of Patrick at that meeting, too. And he shook my hand, and he said that he'd be more than willing to talk to me if I needed someone to talk to. And I wrote down his number. He got me a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and asked me if I would be willing to do some reading, and I read the doctor's opinion. And see, I had never been able to grasp the fact that I could possibly be an alcoholic because of the fact that I wasn't one of these people that drank every day, you know. I didn't want to drink every day. I wanted to do the other stuff, you know. Alcohol was kind of like, oh God, how can I say this? The only thing that made sense to me was when I read the doctor's opinion, and I understood what alcoholism really was, you know, and I understood that I chased that effect, the effect produced by alcohol, and, you know, it all started making sense, you know. I had never, not once in my life, had a normal drink. I never drank to be cute. I may have drank to make you look cute, but, you know, there was nothing normal about my drinking, ever, 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 ever. I drank to get drunk, pure and simple. So, you know, I hung out with a lot of people that were kind of serious about the program back then, and some of them were young. You know, they had good messages for me when I first got here. You know, and unfortunately, a lot of them aren't with us anymore. But you know, it was what I needed. You know, and I engulfed myself with them. And then as I started to get more time, and I started getting into the steps more, I started hanging out with like my sponsor and like people that had a little bit more time, and. I don't know, I started really discovering a lot in that first year. You know, I didn't really think that I was going to stay. I didn't really want to believe that I could be an alcoholic, you know. And I remember within 3 months, things started changing. I started feeling better about myself, you know. I started appreciating my life more, you know. Things started coming around for me. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and the reason why I didn't identify at first was because I had a job and I had a place to stay while I was living with a bunch of crackheads, and I was selling drugs to the drive-thru window. So, you know, my sponsor right-sized me and was like, hey, look, you know, you may want to reconsider, you know, your thinking there, you know, and I did, you know, I did. But I can tell you that I thank God for that man, because once we got started on the steps and I did that first step and I was willing to admit that I was powerless over alcohol, I pretty much knew at that point in time, you know, and the rest, you know, I thought it was some kind of race, you know. My friends were all busy doing their steps, and I was like, well, I want to be on step two. So I raced and raced and raced, and then it got to step four, and I was like, okay, all right, I'm chill now. I didn't want to move from the fourth step, and I think I sat on that step for like a month and a half, and my sponsor would ask me, are you done with your fourth step? Are you done with your fourth step? Oh, yeah, you know, I'm getting there. I just have a little bit more writing to do. And needless to say, one of the kids that was living at ASA, which is across the street from where the Alano Club used to be, committed suicide and blew his brains out. And I got serious and called him the next day and said, okay, I'm done. Let me, you know, come over. I have to do my fifth step with you. It was really, really, that was my turning point in my recovery. I knew that the reason why I had to do the steps, you know, and I knew the reason why they were so important, because I didn't want to end up like him. And, you know, by that time, a lot of the people that had come in with me were dropping off like flies, too. And I didn't like, you know, a couple of them had come back and they were miserable. And I was just like, wow, you know, it started sinking in that I could be one of them. And I didn't want to be, you know, relapse scared the heebie-jeebies out of me. And So I remember I was in service a lot too. Like, I'd give people rides to meetings, and for the longest time I secretaried like 2 or 3 meetings at a time. You know, I was very, very active in my recovery. I still am. Like, I go to a lot of meetings, and I have a couple of service commitments, but I'm not like I was back in the day. And you know, I noticed that as I got more time in recovery, I started getting more responsibilities. You know, like the job that I was selling drugs to the drive-thru decided to make me a member of their management team, and now I have one of their stores, and they trust me with a combination of the safe. And that just baffles me to this day. I'm like, wow, you know, and there's not a lot of money in the safe, but still, you know, it's like I have access to all that money. I could very well go to the Chumash Casino and just, you know, have a good time, but I don't. You know, they trust me, and that feels really good today, you know. I got to earn that trust, you know, and I don't know, Alcoholics Anonymous, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think the reason why I took so old Alcoholics Anonymous was because I finally felt that I fit in somewhere. I had never fit in anywhere. I didn't fit in at home. I sure as hell didn't fit in at school. I always felt that I was just kind of one of those people that people could do without, you know. And I didn't think that anybody cared about me. I had no self-worth whatsoever until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And you guys told me to keep coming back. You guys were there to shake my hand. You guys were there to hug me. I don't remember, there must have been like 6 or 7 times that I called people, hey, I'm not in a good space, can I come over? It'd be like 3 o'clock in the morning, hey, let's go to Denny's, let's have some coffee, you know, I'll sit and talk to you. And people did that for me. You know, I was that sick, I needed that, you know. And I was, I was a smart motherfucker when I came in too, because I thought that, there was no way I could be an alcoholic. And, you know, I didn't think that I was going to stay. I was too smart for the program. You know, I had all the answers. You know, by the first 3 weeks that I was here, I was like, okay, well, I can probably drink normally. You know, I'm not like you guys. Bullshit. I was, you know. But when those things started changing inside me and I started getting my self-esteem back and my self-worth, you know, from working the steps, and, you know, that meant a lot to me because I'd never felt like that before. Never, ever, ever. You know, it's like that hole and that emptiness and that ick that I was trying to fill with all those drugs and all that alcohol was finally beginning to dissipate and just beginning to go away. I could look in the mirror and I wasn't repulsed by who I saw. And I don't know, it's like things that definitely aren't perfect today. You know, I have a decent relationship with my son. My dad is kind of hit and miss. You know, I know that he feels a lot kind of guilty for everything that happened with my stepmom and me. Consequently, she died when I was 19 of cirrhosis. She had burned basically all the bridges with the family, so no one would have anything to do with her. I went to the hospital every day that she was there and prayed with her and spent her last days with her. You know, and this woman, I should not have done something like that. You know, and I don't, to this day, I can't tell you why I did, but I think it was God's way of telling me that I needed to forgive her and I needed to move on. And I did, and it was the most horrific thing that I've ever seen. You know, and I remember telling myself, I'm not going to be like that. I'm not going to be an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. But, you know, I have hope. I have hope because of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't have to die that death that I saw her die. You know, you know, because of the step work, I learned that I was one of these people that you know, came in here with a sob story, you know, and I will say that you know, the stuff that happened to me, no child should have ever had to go through, you know. You know, to this day, it still kind of bothers me a little bit sometimes, you know, but I get through it, I pray about it, you know, I talk to others about it. You know, I don't let it hold me down like I did, you know. I used to just, you know, it was like, poor me, and that's, you know, I hated myself. I really hated myself, you know, and I got to get over all that stuff. I got to get over that shame, you know. Yeah, it happened. It's tragic, but it's time to let it go. You know, it's time to let it go. And that was the hardest thing because I didn't want to, because that was my safety net. You know, I wanted people to feel sorry for me. Well, I don't really care anymore. You know, I just I don't want that extra baggage anymore. I really don't. You know, I have a very simple life today. I keep it very simple. I can't have 10 things going on at once with me today. It's work, and then when I'm at work, I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to eat when I get home? And that's it. That's as complicated as my life gets today, and that's the way that I like to keep it. I pray to God. I say that I trust in Him, and that's true, like, when things are going my way, but when they're not, you know, that's a different story. But, you know, I pray. I do everything that I'm supposed to do. I have a really good relationship with my sponsor. I'm at a loss for words when it comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I still find it almost impossible to believe that I was the same person that came here 6 years ago. And, you know, like, everything that's gone, you know, I should have been one of these people to go back out and drink. I really should have. I lost my grandmother, or my grandfather. He passed away in recovery. I lost a couple of cousins. I don't know how many members we buried, you know, that went back out, and just some horrific things that have happened, you know, since I've been sober. One of my sponsees committed suicide. He hung himself. And I remember when they told me that he hung himself, I was devastated. And I was like, wow, you know. And, you know, I told myself that I was never going to sponsor anybody again, blah, 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 yada, yada, yada. Here we go with the poor me crap again. Yes, it was. It was very, very sad, you know. A wise man, Al McGee, told me that if I took credit for people's failures, or if I took credit for their successes, that I have to take credit for their failures too. And I'm just not willing to do that today. I'm just here with a message of hope, you know. And I want my higher power to use me, you know, in that way. I don't want my higher power to. I don't want it to be any different. I don't want to be idolized. I don't want to be put on the pedestal. I just want to be me. I just want to live and enjoy my life today. You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous has done that for me. You know, and it continues to do that for me. You know, I don't know. I just I've gotten to the point where, like, I don't know, like, the first few years were pretty chaotic in my recovery, you know, especially with all the stuff that was going on. And this year, you know, some things have happened that, yeah, I guess they could be pretty chaotic, you know. But nothing big. And the thing is like, you know, like, what used to be really big for me is just no big deal today. You know, I used to drink over the stupidest things, and now I've had some pretty crappy things happen in recovery, and I didn't have to drink, and that just, it still baffles me to this day. You know, burying my grandfather, being around all my relatives that were talking crap about me the whole entire time I was there, and not once did I have to pick up a drink, you know, and not once did I have to go through any of this alone, you know. I think the reason why I like Alcoholics Anonymous so much is because you guys became my family, the family that I never had, you know. I came in here and I was such a broken person, and you guys helped me put me back together again, you know. I just lost my train of thought. So anyway, yes, I'm really grateful to be here today. And Billy, thanks for asking me to speak. I just lost my train of thought again. It's time for me to shut up. Thank you.
Thank you.
James,